The Gentle Dentist continues to hear compliments from their patients.
I am so glad we found the Gentle Dentist. It is truly pain-free. Not just for me, but I'm so happy my children have had such a wonderful experience. They love the Smile Club.
I'm a business owner, so every minute of my time is valuable. I love that they are so respectful of my time.
The Gentle Dentist in Worthington. Call now. New patients receive a free sonic toothbrush with a cleaning and exam. Call 614-431-3311.
Morant. Oh! A jawbreaker! James, 2 seconds, 1 second for the win! Uh-oh! LeBron James delivers! The drive, reverse. Oh, what a play! Anthony Atkinson has tied it up. 4 seconds left. Melvick, stole away! He's got time! Atkinson, layup! Good! Good! Is your national champion!
And this will end it after the shovel, or will it? Miami running around, circling. Oh, look out! Gronkowski didn't have the angle! Touchdown! A miracle!
And that is a very familiar voice of Ian Eagle of CBS Sports, the Brooklyn Nets, and starting this fall, Amazon Prime Video. And he is the guest on a special edition of the Sports Media Watch podcast. I'm John Lewis, and in a moment, my co-hosts Armand Brody, producer Derek Futterman, and I will be joined by Ian Eagle for a discussion about his career, his new role at Prime Video, and much, much more. But first, if you have not already, please subscribe to the SMW podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. That's where you can hear some other interviews we've done recently, including with Mike Greenberg this past week, Kevin Harlan, James Brown, Chris Myers, and we have more in the pipeline as well. We have Kenny Albert coming up. We have Michael Grady coming up. So make sure you subscribe to the SMW podcast feed, and you can listen to all of these great interviews. And, of course, the insightful sports media conversation that Armand, Derek, and I have on a weekly basis. All right, with no further ado, let's get straight to the interview. Well, we are very honored and pleased to be joined today by Ian Eagle, one of the best-known play-by-play voices in this industry. You have heard him on CBS doing the NCAA Men's Basketball Tournament as the lead voice. Also doing the NFL, you have heard him do the New Jersey Nets and Brooklyn Nets now, and on the NBA, you will be hearing him on Amazon Prime Video this fall. Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be on with you guys. Just nice to hear New Jersey Nets again, a blast from the past, which was such a staple, but now they've been in Brooklyn for long enough that there's been a whole generation of fans that only know them as the Brooklyn Nets. And I've noticed that just going to Brooklyn, that when I started doing games there, kids that were 5, 6, 7 years old, now you meet them again and they're young adults, and it just shows you that they've made an imprint. It's been pretty impressive that they've gotten into the marketplace and there's been an impact.
Yeah. Well, why don't we start with the Nets? It's such an interesting thing because the Nets have a network quality broadcast, which is very rare. Now, in the big markets like New York and LA, you will have very high quality broadcasts, but you could put the Nets broadcast on a conference final game, and I don't think people would have any issue with it, which is very rare for what we see on RSNs. What is it about the Nets broadcast? I mean, what is it about this approach that you have to a team that, with all due respect to the Nets, not the most famous team, not the most popular, and yet you have a broadcast that is at that level?
Well, that's extremely high praise, and it's very much appreciated. I've been working Nets games. This will be my 32nd year, so it's very much part of who I am as a broadcaster. It was the first place where I got a big break on the play-by-play side, and I've maintained the association in many ways because there's still a deep connection and a labor of love. I think the approach really stemmed from John Filippelli, who came over to run the YES Network, who had been at NBC and he had been at Fox and he had been at ABC. He had very big jobs within the industry and came in with the idea and theory that this network can be placed on a very high level and should maintain a certain standard because of the fact that they're associated with the New York Yankees and it's the New York market. And he hired a lot of people from the network level to come over and work the broadcasts. And it's just been a trickle-down effect through the years. A longtime partnership with Frank DeGrace, who I worked with on the net side. And if you don't know the name, he's now running the NBA at NBC. So that should tell you all you need to know about how others were consuming what Yes was doing and then recognizing that it was very much at the top of the heap in how to present the NBA. So the fact that you've got Ryan Rucco and you've got Sarah Kustak and Richard Jefferson and Vince Carter, my son Noah doing broadcasts as well, and then we could go through a litany of sideline reporters who have gone on to greater success, including Michael Grady, who is going to be working at Amazon Prime Video and NBC Peacock. So it's a laundry list of high-quality people that wanted to do the job at a high level. And no matter what the record was from the team, sometimes good and sometimes not so good, the broadcast always viewed itself as an entity that was going to be at a standard of excellence.
And Brooklyn just really started to get national appeal as a basketball team when Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, and eventually James Harden joined the Nets. And now they're going to be big pieces here as you enter your first season with Amazon. So having done games for TNT for such a long time, what are you most excited for in doing NBA games, first time that NBA games are going to be exclusive to a streamer?
Well, one thing I've realized for myself when I started in this business at WFAN Radio out of college and then made the move to play-by-play with the Nets, the Jets, CBS, and a number of other outlets since, I like being part of a team. I enjoy the collaborative aspect. I really relish the idea of everyone coming together collectively to put on a good show. And that means doing the job well, but also doing it with an eye towards entertainment and recognizing that we have a varied audience and different degrees of fandom within that audience. So what I've noticed with Amazon Prime Video, we had a seminar out in LA in August. There is a shared spirit and love for the NBA. They are excited about getting involved with the NBA. And I think it comes at a pretty important time for the league that they recognize that it's time for some new stars to be developed and to help tell that story is what Amazon Prime Video will do. And it's also that balance of doing hardcore basketball for that faction of the audience and then recognizing that there are moments of levity and entertainment and a game in October, November, December, January onward through the playoffs still leaves you places to find some of the lightness that comes with calling sports. So that's been really my philosophy from the beginning, is I want to take the job seriously, which I do completely, the preparation, the performance side. But I also want to understand that we are still in the toy department in many ways. And I feel like that should be the tone of a broadcast, that I'm going to be serious when it calls for it, but I'm also going to find a playful side of this when that's appropriate.
Ian, it is difficult to find someone who has a negative thing to say about you, anything close to negative. But I want to know this. You're so well known for building chemistry with your partners, but I want to know, has there been a time when you've been really angry in the booth? Upset, frustrated about something, and how did you handle that?
Not really, to be perfectly frank. I try to bring a very positive attitude. I learned early on, without giving away any names, that a few analysts that I had worked with came in very serious, and I watched it affect those around me, where the whole tenor was towards the negative. of trying to avoid confrontation and walking on eggshells and not knowing exactly when they could speak. And I thought to myself, this is no way to do this job. And I probably overcompensated back then in some way. And I can look back on it now and see it. In the moment, I felt that was the only way to handle it, to make sure that the people on the crew recognized my appreciation for them, learning their name, knowing their background, learning about their kids. This is not that hard to do in life. This is what we're supposed to do on a human level. So to me, that was truly the way that I then approached it every year that I've done it. I really have never had any issues with any analyst that I've worked with. I've rarely had any crossed words with them. You know, the funniest part about it is the clip that went viral many years ago with me and Mike Fratello, which was a complete bit. You know, Mike and I had been doing that for multiple years of ranking on one another and trying to see how far we could push the envelope. And at that point, I had somehow become Andy Kaufman. It had become some kind of performance art because I could not believe the reaction. And Mike couldn't believe the reaction. After we went to commercial for that one particular segment that ended up going wild on the internet, he high-fived me because I got him. Like, that was the mentality. And we left the arena together that night, and I drove him back to his hotel in Newark. We had no idea that people would misunderstand what we did or misrepresent. It was a really good lesson for me, though, because I did learn that things can sometimes spiral out of control and you do not control the narrative. And all I could do in that moment was really laugh it off. And Mike and I, there are probably 30 to 40 examples of he and I doing bits of some sort during those games to keep one another entertained. The team was not very good at that point. So I thought it was funny and ironic that I ended up getting a lot of attention for something that I very consciously went the other way on to make sure that people understood I was trying to do what was correct and best for my partner in any broadcast forum. And that was going back to the old days of doing talk shows on WFAN and Sirius XM, or pre and post game shows or games. That's the job in my mind. As a play-by-play announcer, you're supposed to be malleable and you're supposed to adjust to the analyst, not the other way around. At least that's the way I've always viewed it.
Now, way back at the start of your career, you produced Mike Tirico's radio show back at WFBL. And you're talking about, between you and Mike Tirico, that's an unbelievable pairing to have at this local radio station. What was that like, one, working with Mike back then? And two, can you just kind of speak to that concentration of talent at that time?
Yeah, so the background on that, it was my sophomore year at Syracuse, 1987. I went out to cover a high school football game for one of the student radio stations on campus, WJPZ Z89. They would assign a bunch of us to go do voicers at a high school football game. They would do a wrap-up show. I was still early on in my college years. I was thrilled to have the assignment. Me and a friend of mine went out to cover the game. David Fleischer, who has unfortunately since passed, one of my very close friends at Syracuse. We go to the game and Mike Tirico is on the sideline of the game. He had just started as the weekend sports anchor at WTVH, the CBS affiliate in Syracuse. And I think back on it now, it's funny to ponder exactly what led up to us going up to him. But basically, I pointed out to David, hey, that's Mike Tirico. We've seen him on TV. He was a senior in college at the time. So that just shows you what was happening in his life, that he was finishing his college years while also doubling up as the local weekend anchor at the CBS affiliate. So I mentioned to David, hey, there's Mike Tirico. He says, yeah, that is Mike Tirico. He said, why don't we go up to him, say hello? And I said, no, I don't want to bother the guy. He said, no. He'd love to meet us. He was right. I followed his lead. We went, we introduced ourselves. I quickly learned that Mike grew up in Bayside, Queens. I grew up in Forest Hills, Queens in New York. You're talking about a 12-minute ride from one to the other. We shared a lot in common and we hit it off. He ended up inviting us to the TV station to watch him do his sportscast, which we did. He ended up inviting us to be interns at the TV station, which we did. I stuck with it. I was an intern my sophomore year. I was an intern my junior year. I was an intern my senior year. I ended up helping produce his Sunday night show oftentimes. And then he approached me my senior year and said, hey, I have this opportunity to host a radio station on the AM dial in Syracuse on Sunday night in between the 6 o'clock and 11 o'clock news. I'd love for you to produce it. I'll give you $50 a show. I was like, $50? I'm in. I mean, that was wings, beer, and money to spare. So I end up producing the show, and Mike is a very busy man at that point. He's juggling a lot. I end up hosting the show on occasion because there were times where Mike couldn't do it. So it turned into so much more. The funny part about it, when I think through the sequencing, I had interned at WFAN Radio in between my junior and senior year. And there was a producer at the time for Mike and the Mad Dog by the name of Bob Gelb, legendary producer. And Bob had a Rolodex of phone numbers. This is 1989. And those phone numbers, it was like gold. These were direct lines to athletes, coaches, front office members. This is before the internet. And I had the very wise decision to make. Do I photocopy those numbers? Which I did. And I brought them with me to Syracuse. And now, when I was named the producer of this show for Mike, I had all these numbers of athletes, coaches, etc. And I used them. I would call up people trying to book them for Mike's show, and I got a bunch. There was one particular call that I remember. It was Pat Dye, the head coach at Auburn, and I had his number. I said, you know what? I'm just going to call him up. And I don't know if you remember, but Auburn and Syracuse very famously tied in the 1987 season for what could have been the national championship. And Pat Dye went for the tie. He kicked the field goal instead of going for the win. So I call up Pat Dye, and he picks up. I said, hey, coach, it's Ian Eagle, producer with Mike Tirico in Syracuse. He said, son, where'd you get this number? I said, oh, we had it in our records, coach. I don't even know what I'm saying at that point. He said, son, you're going to need to go through the proper channels if you want to talk with me on a radio show. I said, oh, I mean, I have you right now, so we could just put you on the air with Mike. He says, no, son, I don't think you understand. You're going to have to go through the proper channels. So that was two proper channels. He did not come on the radio show. That was not going to happen for Pat Dye. But I did get him on the phone. So the moral behind the story is that I took the job very seriously, and Mike and I formed a very close friendship because of it. I was at his wedding. He was at my wedding. And to this day, he is still one of my very best friends, not just in the industry, but in life.
Did you at that time, obviously you're all very young, you're at the start of your careers, could you have ever envisioned the two of you being where you are today?
I can honestly say that I could have envisioned him being there. He was that gifted. He stood out from the very beginning. He just had an incredible knack as a communicator, his versatility, his humanity. I learned so much from him in observing him, and then just how he treated people and how he treated the job. So you'd have to ask Mike the flip side of it with me. But I know from my perspective, there was no doubt in my mind that Mike was going to make it big in the industry. It was just a matter of where, and it was just a matter of when. But there was absolute belief from not just me, but from everybody around him that Mike was going to be a huge success.
Now, something that's been a through line in your career is staying in the New York market. I know you had job offerings out of college to go to West Virginia or Buffalo to be a host there, and you decided to take a producer role at WFAN. From there, that eventually a chain of events, NBA Entertainment, leads to the Nets job. I think you got the call on a payphone. And then the Jets job comes shortly after that, where you do it on the radio for WFAN. What was the advantage to starting in media market number one in New York, where you continue to have a presence today with the Brooklyn Nets and on national games?
Yeah, I think back on it now, Derek, and there was definitely a little bit of a Pollyannic view at the time of envisioning how this could all go. And, you know, maybe I also didn't quite understand how all of this works. And sometimes ignorance is bliss. So to me, it was very straightforward in that I wanted to eventually be in New York. And this gave me the opportunity to get to New York. And the very simple view that I had at that point was, I'm going to get to know the people that will ultimately make the decision as to whether or not I should be on the air in New York. Now, I'm going to do it in a circuitous way. And I recognized very early that they hired me to be a producer. They did not hire me to be on the air. They made it very clear to me that if I wanted to be on the air, I should go somewhere else. And I still took the job with the idea that you build trust, you allow people to get to know you. And over time, in this particular case, I took the job and started in May of 1990. My first on-air opportunity, true on-air opportunity, was September of 1991. Now, this links to something earlier. Mike Tirico left for ESPN in 1991 and reached out to me and said, look, the job is going to open up. You should apply. And I thought about it. I pondered the idea of going back to Syracuse and maybe giving up on this pipe dream of making it happen in New York City. Ultimately, I stuck with the plan, and the plan worked out. When young broadcasters ask me for advice, I try to lay out all the options, and there's no right answer. This is what worked for me. I had a very clear belief of what I thought it could be, but it also required people to truly believe in me along the way, which you never quite know how that's going to go. It's based on an opportunity coming up, and literally, as cliche as it is, somebody got sick. And I got a chance to do updates at WFAN because an update person was dealing with a bout of pneumonia. He was fine, so I don't want this to go sideways. He was A-okay, but I got my chance, and then they put me on the schedule the next week, and then the next week, and the next week. And by the end of that year, 1991, they started viewing me in a different way. I had knocked down that initial wall of perception that you're just a production guy, and made the transition and really opened up the doors for a lot of others at WFAN, because at the time it was not commonplace. Eventually, it became much more commonplace for Bob Wischusen and Sweeney Murdy and Chris Carlin and others, many others, that Mark Malusis, that did production work, and then eventually got the chance to be on the air.
Your son Noah has become one of the fastest rising stars in broadcasting. And I want to know, I mean, I'm sure you get asked about him all the time, but I want to know from you, hopefully this is a bit of a different angle. What does he do at his age that is maybe better than what you were doing at the same age?
Yeah, so he's 28 right now. And at 28 years old, I did call my first game at CBS. It was a college basketball game, Arkansas, Vanderbilt. And it was just before my 29th birthday. So it was All-Star Weekend, 1998. And this is where you can't predict things in life. The opportunity popped up because CBS was doing the Winter Olympics in Nagano, Japan, and they had zero announcers left in the United States. That's it. I got a call because they didn't have options. And that weekend, three of us did college basketball games. It was the weekend right before the start of the Nagano Olympics. It was me. It was Jim Durham, who has since passed, was a brilliant voice in the NBA, mostly known for his work with the Chicago Bulls, but then ESPN Radio, the NBA on ESPN Radio. And Joel Myers, a highly accomplished play-by-play announcer who's still doing the NBA with the New Orleans Pelicans. We were the three announcers that did games that weekend. And I could do the game only based on the fact that I was available. I didn't have an NBA game that weekend because it was NBA All-Star weekend. And I remember very vividly thinking to myself, this could lead to nothing, or this could be the start of something. So that's the main difference, is that at 28, I was getting my first taste of it. One game, a one-off. And Noah at 28 now is 6 years into a network career, having done games for CBS, Fox, and NBC. So I just think there's a polish that he has seen the process sped up a bit. And the other part, which you don't know until you're in it, is how you handle the big stage and the big moment, because there's no simulating it. Now, my advantage was I had done a ton of games. Having started doing the NBA in 1994, I just had a lot of reps and I tried things. There was trial and error. There was the development of a style. There was finding my voice, which I look back now on some of the calls from 98 and 99 and 2000, and I hear the makings of who I eventually became. But at the time, I was trying to figure it out, just like everybody else. I think where Noah has benefited the most is that he's had a chance to do it at a high level. And with that, you now have a greater understanding of how to bring it, of how to deliver in the moment, how to capture that specific call that you're looking for, how to line it up that way. The Olympics gave him incredible training, on-the-job training for high-level play, and then you better match it as an announcer, because these moments are going to live forever. You get one take. I'm going to quote Eminem, you get one opportunity. That's it.
When announcers are the son of another announcer, the daughter of another announcer, we hear the nepotism discussion. And so often we ask the announcer, him or herself, how they deal with that. But we don't typically ask the parent, right? You know, I don't know what Jack Buck thought about what people said about Joe, or what Ernie Johnson Sr. thought about what people said about EJ. How do you feel when you see some of the reaction on social media or even just in the critical press, when people maybe suggest that Noah didn't get to where he is on his own?
Well, I'm a dad first. So we're colleagues and we're both play-by-play announcers, but ultimately I'm his dad. And that's always going to be my role in this relationship. So when it comes to your kid, anything that he feels, good or bad, makes you feel tenfold what he's feeling in both directions, to be perfectly honest. So in the good moments, the glee that you have as a father, as a parent, that resonates more than anything else. And if this is true in any father-son, father-daughter, mother-son, mother-daughter relationship, if there's any kind of adversity or struggle, you feel that as well. So the easy answer is, I'm his father, and anything that might be considered critical, of course I'm going to feel, but I also take my cues from him, and ultimately, he's the one living his life. He's the one that decided that he wanted to pursue this, and that gives him joy to do this job. It gives me joy as a parent to watch him do it. but he is the one that has to live his life. So I follow his lead more often than not. And I'm certainly not one that makes our relationship be defined by the broadcast side. It's secondary. Ultimately, it's a big part of our dynamic, but it's not the main part. You know, as far as him in this industry, look, the one thing I know, being a play-by-play announcer, if you don't do the job well, you're going to hear about it, no matter what your name is, no matter what your background is. And if you do the job well, then most people just focus on the job and they don't necessarily focus on the last name. The biggest piece of advice I gave him when he started was be yourself, commit yourself to being the best version of yourself, and do your job well. You need to be good at it in order to maintain a career in this. And that doesn't matter what the background is. That's just reality.
This is year number one with J.J. Watt on the CBS side of things after you've been with Charles Davis for the previous five seasons. Of course, he's moving over to the college football booth next season with the retirement of Gary Danielson to work with Brad Nessler there. What has it been like, first of all, working with J.J. and reflecting back working with Charles? What are your expectations into the new role next year for him?
Yeah, first of all, on the Charles front, we had just a glorious 5 years together. Partnership, a friendship. We were in lockstep with one another of how to do this job, how to approach the job, and had a lot of fun every week. And I'm really fortunate that I had that experience with him. You just never know in network partnerships. These are all arranged marriages. You don't get to choose your partner. Someone else chooses it for you. So my viewpoint of that is always, hey, find what they do really well, your analyst. Do your best to highlight what they do well. And if there are any areas where they need a little bit of help, maybe you can lend a hand to make sure that's smooth or smoother than maybe it's been in the past. For Charles, I think it's going to be a great situation. He's in a really excellent spot right now with two pros, with Andrew Catalan and Jason McCourty, two guys that care about their work, two guys that are really good people. And I've had a chance to hear their broadcast. It sounds excellent. They have fit really well together. As we know, for Charles, it's going to be a step to another role, and that's the college role on CBS. Brad Nessler is one of the best to ever do it. And Craig Silver, who is the producer of that show, who I've worked with on numerous broadcasts, I know is excited to have Charles there. Gary Danielson is getting his flowers this year, and rightfully so. He has been as consistently good as anyone in that position. And now Charles is going to flex that muscle, and I think is going to be outstanding going back to the college game where he excelled in a previous iteration at Fox and at Turner. So when you get a new partner, you've got to figure out where the common ground is. And what I quickly discovered with JJ is he cares a lot. He is a football junkie. He puts in the prep. He obviously has a great deal of experience, but here's where the secret sauce comes in. He has a legitimate sense of humor and is self-deprecating. So this is a guy who won three Defensive Player of the Year awards, a perennial Pro Bowler, will be a first ballot Hall of Famer, made a boatload of money, is a specimen, as you may have seen in our week one shot of the booth. And yet he can make fun of himself and wants to be part of the team. That really stood out from the beginning. And in my mind, it's now my job to lean in on that when it's applicable. And I think JJ quickly realized that I like to have fun and we can have fun together with Evan Washburn and still do right by the teams that are playing and by the athletes that are on display.
Do you ever get the sense, you talk about having fun in the booth, do you ever get the sense that there's almost a penalty that a play-by-play person pays for having fun? And that when it's time to select someone to do the Super Bowl, the NBA Finals, you know, the really big games, that those announcers who do have some bits, like you had with Mike Fratello, that you kind of maybe get overlooked?
I don't know, John. I think that there was a time where the business was set up in a way that those that did the Super Bowl or did the NBA Finals or did the Final Four or the World Series, that it was your classic voice and you were trained a certain way, and America could only accept those that did it in a certain manner and had a certain sound. And I think as the years have gone by, we have seen some play-by-play announcers that have broken the mold a bit. Mike Emmerich became the voice of hockey. He was not the typical hockey announcer. He had some higher range in his voice and he had excitability and he wasn't a classic baritone. And he found ways in which to describe things, wordplay, entertain, and then bring the juice that became a bit of the norm in the NHL. It wasn't the classic way of doing it. And I think we're now at a time, certainly within our industry, with the advent of sports talk and sports podcasts and hot take shows, where different voices are heard, and you don't necessarily have to sound a certain way in order to get to a certain level. So I've probably benefited from that in some way. I had an interesting journey at CBS because I started very young and I had experienced older announcers in front of me. And CBS certainly had a methodology at the time of how they wanted to do games. And they stuck by that for a very long time. And it worked. It very much was effective. And as I was a little bit on the edges of maybe breaking through, I found a way to marry that mentality with my own approach, which was be yourself and maybe a bit more conversational in certain ways. It's always interesting when you get into process, because there's a finite group of people that are really interested in it, and you three certainly qualify. You care. You are curious about what makes a broadcast good, or why one stands out, or one broadcaster hits and another one doesn't. And then the majority of people don't even ponder the subject. They just turn the game on and they know if they're comfortable or not. And that really is what it comes down to. Can you make the viewer or the listener comfortable when you're doing the game? We all have experienced it when we've turned a game on and something just doesn't feel right. Whatever that is, it could be the voice of the announcer. It could be the byplay between the announcers. It could be the volume in which they're doing the game, too loud, too soft, not enough energy, too much energy. We just know it. It's something that's very innate in you as a viewer, and you don't know why, but you just know. And I think that's the place where announcers want to get to. You want to get to the place where someone turns on the game. The ultimate compliment is when they turn on the game and they know it's you. And if they know it's you, they know what they're getting. They know that they're going to get a professional, entertaining broadcast. And for me, after all these years doing the NBA, doing the NFL, doing college basketball, a bunch of other sports through the years, I think that probably has been the greatest achievement that I've attained, and that is getting to that place where people know you and they know what to expect from you.
What should viewers expect this year from an Amazon NBA broadcast? What may look different? What can we kind of expect going in?
Well, I think first and foremost, the biggest key that I noticed when Amazon Prime Video started doing the NFL was that it looked like the NFL and it sounded like the NFL. That's the first step. So for Amazon Prime Video and the NBA, it's got to look like the NBA. It's got to sound like the NBA. And then once you've established that trust with the viewers, now you can try some things. But the rudimentary part of this, the fundamental aspect of broadcasting, is putting people in their comfort zone. And you want to have an exhale effect when people tune in for the first time. You just want them to sit back, find it, and then enjoy. Don't question it. Don't ask, what is this? Why is this different than what I'm accustomed to? And once you get through that phase, I think you can bring in some innovation. And what I have learned very quickly with the people at Amazon Prime Video is they're really smart. They view things through a different prism. It's not necessarily the same old way of doing sports on television. They have people that had nothing to do with sports, but are looking at it through a certain lens. And with that, you have a chance to maybe do something unique. And I think that's part of what they want to do, but I don't think they want to hit people over the head with it. It will be gradual. And I think there will be some chances taken. And if they don't work, that's okay too. But they're willing to try some things, which is important when you're starting something new.
There's quite a cast with the Amazon crew. You got a lot of folks who have been announced. In terms of who you'll be working with, is there a lead analyst that Amazon Prime has identified? Do you know who you'll be calling some of the biggest playoff games with yet, Ian?
Well, I think Stan Van Gundy will certainly be involved. And I don't know if they're going to declare any particular crew. I think you'll see a mix and match. And I'm actually very open to that. I like the idea of working with different partners. I think it keeps you on your toes. It shows that you can come at this from a different angle, and it challenges you. It tests you as a broadcaster. I've always enjoyed that part of the business, finding a way to mesh and creating chemistry. But I think Stan will end up doing a lion's share of the big games. Brent Barry will be heavily involved. And we can go through the litany of analysts that have come on board. Dwayne Wade will do some games. Steve Nash will do some games. I wouldn't be surprised if you see Jim Jackson on games and Candace Parker on games, Del Curry. You know, we're going on and on here because I think they want to try some things and they want to mix and match. And you'll see some three-person booths along the way, studio. You've got a litany of analysts there with the likes of Blake Griffin and Dirk Nowitzki and Udonis Haslam and Steve Nash and Dwayne Wade and John Wall and Rudy Gay. Kyle Lowry was recently announced. So they are going for it and they want to attack this thing in a way that provides the viewer with the most insight and basketball knowledge and then fun. That's the other part. That was very clear to me from our meeting in August. They want to have fun doing this.
Ian, throughout your career, there have been instances where you've kind of been the number two announcer in the network property. Here, it's been reported you're going to be the lead guy, and it's kind of echoes taking the lead on March Madness 2 years ago as the play-by-play announcer for the Final Four. What added responsibility does that give you, kind of being entrusted with the biggest matchups?
Yeah, I'm in charge. I'm in charge of the whole operation. I'm the guy. No, not much. Go call the games. Go do good work. Go make the people that you're working with better. and represent the company the best that you can. And by the way, no matter where I've been in the pecking order, that's how I've viewed the job. And that was always so interesting to me when I started at CBS. There were those that were on my crew that would point out, we're going to 8% of the country this week. And then the next week, we're going to 12% of the country this week. And I said, oh, so you want me to be 4% better? What is it that you want? I'm going to be the same. I'm going to do the game the same way. There's a consistency in this job that is required. And I don't know what year it was, but NBA, NFL, college hoops, there was a point where I got to a place where I felt like I was finally in command of what I was doing. That doesn't mean I did a poor job prior to it. It just means that all the hours that you put in, all the games that you've banked, put me in a position where I felt comfortable on the air, loose to do my job, but the responsibility that came with that job, knowing that at any moment you might make a call that goes down as the call of the year or the gaffe of the year. And it doesn't matter how many games you've done. It doesn't matter how many Hall of Fames you're in. You still got to do it. The games happen in front of you and you still have to call them. Nobody in the audience at that moment says, wow, I loved this announcer 3 years ago. They want to know what you can do now, today, tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. So that's the constant motivation for this job is the games keep coming. And it's your job to match and meet the moment.
Early in your career, very early, you said that Bob Costas was your biggest influence by far. And you also won the Bob Costas scholarship when you were in high school as well. As you move along, you know, it's an interesting career journey that a lot of us, whatever we're in, take. We start out being too young to know what we're doing. And then we get old enough to realize, uh-oh, wait, let me make sure I'm doing this well. And then we get comfortable. What you just said in response to Derek, I feel like you're now in that comfortable zone of your career. Now that you are in that space, are you still someone who is influenced by those predecessors like Bob Costas? Or are you so in your element and knowing exactly what you need to do every game that you are your own biggest influence at this point?
Yeah, it's an interesting query because I don't forget those who influenced me, and Bob is right at the top of the list, and Marv Albert is on that list, and Brent Musburger and Dick Enberg and Vern Lundquist. All of them played a role just by watching them week in and week out and taking mental notes of how they did the job. The funny thing with Costas is it was $1,000, the scholarship, and I got a personal check from Bob Costas and his then wife, Randy Costas. It had their names on the check and Bob signed it. And I remember getting the check and I turned to my dad and said, I don't think I'm going to cash this. He said, what? I said, this is going to be a collector's item. Like, I shouldn't cash this. He said, are you a moron? I said, am I? I don't know. It's $1,000. Go cash the check. He was right, by the way. But youth, sometimes you don't know any better. I think when you strip away everything and realize that you're doing what you dreamed of doing for your life, you never take it for granted. And the fact that my son is doing it now, I think, probably has given me added insight, living vicariously through him as he's taken his journey and the conversations that we've had with him preparing for events or how to handle situations. You know, I'm not one to give him a laundry list of things to work on. That's not our dynamic. But I can point out something that I've heard and do it in a manner that connects with him. And it's helped me. It really has, because on Saturday nights, I got to be honest, prior to him doing this job, I was not watching football. I was getting away from football and trying to find something else to occupy my thoughts. Usually I would shut it down 9 p.m. on a Saturday night. All my work's done. My preparation is complete. And I'd watch something else on TV or stream something else. And now I'm locked in to the Big Ten on NBC every Saturday night. So it's changed my routine, but I think it's also probably made me sharper in many ways because I'm paying attention to him and how he approaches the job and some of the vernacular that he uses. So it's a constant process. And I think, John, you would probably appreciate this more than most. You're always a student of this. That part never leaves you. You're always learning something. You're always trying to improve and polish your skills. And anyone who thinks they're a finished product as a broadcaster is barking up the wrong tree, because you never have the perfect broadcast. That's what you aspire to, and it never comes.
Heading into this upcoming season, you've been balancing a lot of roles for a long time. You're going to have football, which is ongoing with the NFL on CBS. You have the Nets, as we discussed, and then, of course, the NBA with Amazon Prime Video and later March Madness. When you think about all of these different roles, what is your schedule going to look like this fall in terms of the amount of games you're going to do for Amazon? What is that configuration, at least maybe in the first half of the season? Because I know like Kevin Harlan's going to be only doing a game a month until January. So what will it look like for you?
Well, first of all, Derek, I'd like to offer you some of my miles. I have accumulated a lot of them, and I just want to gift them to you at this point. I want to share. I want to be kind. And I don't, where do you want to go? You want to go to Tahiti? I can make that happen. This has been years upon years upon years of many, many flights and many different itineraries. And I have the same mentality every year. And that is, when I'm in it, I can't imagine having a day off. I can't even imagine it. Because what you think is a day off is not. You're committing yourself to the work that you're doing for that week and then trying to get ahead for the assignments that are coming up. And then when I'm out of it, meaning summertime where I've not taken as many jobs as I did in the past, I can't imagine working. I can't even wrap my brain around the idea of the schedule that you just described. So, basically, once it starts, I'm all in, and it's all I know. And my family has been incredibly understanding in that. As my two kids were growing up, my wife, who we met at Syracuse, so it's not as if she thought I was going to be a dentist and I pulled a bait and switch on her. This was the goal. She knew the deal. My balance is based on years and years of muscle memory and understanding how to juggle my schedule, how to juggle the preparation, how to get ahead. I'm not someone that procrastinates. I just know how my brain works, and I have to put pen to paper well before I start the actual weekly process of doing these games. And then the travel is the wild card, because I don't control it. That's still out of my control. Yeah, the basic idea for Amazon Prime Video will be somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 games when it's all said and done, between regular season, NBA Cup, play-in, and playoffs. So certainly sizable and a commitment that I recognize going in, and one that I encouraged, wanted to be a part of. The Nets games will go down considerably from what they were. At one point, they were as high as 82. because the Nets did not appear on national TV. And then the number dropped to 70, and then it was down to 60. It was at 52 for a number of years, and the last couple of years had been at 40. And this year, it's really a sliding scale depending upon availability and then how often they need me. Ryan Rucco is going to assume the majority of the responsibility, and I probably will be in the range of 10 to 15 when it's all said and done. And nothing changes on the college basketball front. When CBS needs me to do a game, I will be there to do the game. And that's how we've worked it out. I'm really fortunate to have bosses in different areas that have been understanding and have encouraged me to go out and try to expound on my career. And I don't for one second take that for granted. That means David Burson at CBS and Mike Eby at Westwood One and Jared Stacy at Amazon Prime Video, on and on for years at TNT with Craig Barry and Scooter Vertino. And I'm still working with Turner. They're still involved in the NCAA tournament. So that relationship continues as well.
Let me ask you, we had Kevin Harlan on this past week. Kevin, really, you could sense the reverence he has for radio in our discussion. You mentioned Westwood One and your work for them. How do you approach radio versus television in your career?
Well, first of all, Kevin is the best at it. He is just a premier NFL on radio announcer. There's no one that has shown their passion more for the job. And I think when he entered this field, that was his first love, doing football on the radio. Now he's so gifted that he ended up getting opportunities elsewhere, and he's been incredible in all the roles that he's had. And he's also someone that I've looked up to. It was a little bit different because we were peers in many ways, just based on the jobs that we had together. But when I got the Jets job in 1997, one of the first calls I made was to Kevin, because he was juggling the NFL and the NBA, A, to get his insight, and B, just to better understand how he prepared for a football game. And he's so magnanimous that when I had the Nets-Wolves game, he was doing Timberwolves games at the time, he brought material, showed me how he did it, recognized that he may do it differently than others, and everybody does it their own way. But it gave me great insight, and Kevin is a tremendous friend and someone who I truly admire in this industry and in life. The radio side of it, I think for so many of us, it's the backbone of what you do. It's the entree into the field. When I started doing play-by-play in Syracuse University, it was radio, play-by-play. That was the dream. And to do football and basketball and lacrosse, women's basketball at Syracuse, that gave me so much confidence moving forward that I could handle anything that came my way. I think if you master the radio side, you can edit yourself on the TV side. You just have to be very conscious of it. And then when you flip back and forth, there's got to be a switch in your brain, because someone is going to be cheated in the process. If you're too descriptive on TV, then the person watching is overwhelmed by the verbiage, by the sheer volume of words. And if you're not descriptive enough on radio, then the person driving around in their car or hanging out in their backyard listening to a game doesn't feel like they can actually visualize what they're hearing. You're not painting the word picture. So the ones that do it exceptionally well and the ones that can go back and forth are the ones that can make a conscious effort to truly understand the audience and tailor what they're doing for the medium in which they're doing it.
you have done, Ian, you're now the voice of the Final Four, and you've done the Super Bowl for an international audience. I think you did the finals for an international audience too. Is that right?
I did. I'm very big in Indonesia. I cannot walk the streets. They cheer.
My question, though, is in terms of an American audience, you've not done a Super Bowl. You've not done the finals, but you have done the Final Four. Is it your expectation that at some point in the next maybe 5 to 10 years that you are the voice of the Super Bowl or the voice of the NBA Finals for an American audience? Is that a goal for you?
I can't say it's a goal, and I certainly don't know if it's going to happen. I've learned in this industry not to set expectations and then be disappointed if it doesn't work out. I think there is a perception sometimes of maybe your career's not complete if you don't do X or you don't do Y. I truly do not view it that way. And I think it's just a healthier approach to life. If circumstances work out that way, that would be wonderful. And I would certainly be up to the challenge and would take the assignment and would 100% recognize the value and responsibility that comes with it. But no, it does not keep me up at night, and it's not something that I constantly think about. I think the best thing to happen out of getting the Final Four and doing the Final Four was the mental part of it for me, of getting to that place, like literally physically going into the stadium in Glendale, Arizona. That was the first one I did in 2024 on TBS, and finding a sense of peace. I was so relaxed the entire weekend. And I think I probably had a very conscious compass on myself that I wanted to enjoy it. I didn't want it to overwhelm me. I wanted to do the job in the manner that I had done the job for all of these years. I didn't want to change what I was doing drastically just because it was the Final Four or a bigger stage. I wanted to call the game the way that I would normally call the game. Ironically, the prep, which you would think, perception, whoo, man, what's the prep? The prep was less. I did it the same way, by the way. I still prepared like I would any game, but I realized that for a lot of what I was doing, it was superfluous, and the game was the main course. Cover the game. Call the game. And CBS and Turner put me in that spot to call the game. And that was probably the most eye-opening part of the experience. And now, a year later in 2025, when we actually got 3 excellent games, it really came into effect. And the fact that I had a level of zen helped me. It worked to my advantage that I could just cut loose and do the job the way that I do the job. Now, having Bill Raftery, Grant Hill, Tracy Wolfson, great production team with Ken Mack and Mark Grant, helped immeasurably. But just for myself, I realized don't make it more than it is. And if that were ever to happen for a Super Bowl or for a huge playoff game or an NBA Finals, you name it, big event, that has to be the mentality, at least for me. Don't be on edge. Don't treat it differently than you've treated other assignments, but recognize that the stakes are high and do your job well. And ultimately, I think fans connect to that. If you're in a good place, you put other people in a good place.
Ian, when are they going to put you in the ad with, you know, Spike Lee, Spike Charles, and those guys? When are you going to get in those ads?
I don't know. I did get a Wendy's ad last year, John. I'm sorry you missed it. It was me chewing into a burger with all the trimmings, which for those who know me, That's not something I would necessarily do. I don't eat condiments, and most vegetables do not show up on my list of items that I like to consume. But what happened at that shoot, they mocked up a burger where on the camera side, it had everything, but on the mouth side, it only had meat and bun. So I got through it without any casualties, but I don't make these decisions, John. These decisions are made in offices, and I'm available. I'll just throw it out there right now. I'm available.
Let me get you out of here on this. We actually had Mike Greenberg in today, and Mike is promoting a book that he's written, kind of doing a Mount Rushmore. He went to Syracuse University. Obviously, we all know there's a few universities in this industry that are top tier for talent. Syracuse, where Greenberg went, obviously, Northwestern.
Yeah, I mean, you could just stop at Syracuse. That's okay.
Well, okay. But the Mount Rushmore of Syracuse, I think, would be a pretty tough one to come up with. And I want to present that to you.
Very tough. I would tell you that Marv Albert and Bob Costas are on it prominently. Mike Tirico has made his way on that list as well. And I think Sean McDonough deserves the accolades for what he's done, his versatility, his ability to draw the drama out of any event that he's calling, and doing it in a very honest and highly professional manner. So those would probably be the four that strike me. If you go bigger picture, Dick Clark is the one that really broke through for the entertainment side of things and is someone that made it seem very easy and effortless as a broadcaster. He was just incredibly natural. And you go old school, Marty Glickman was the one that started the cradle of broadcasters. Without Marty, there's no Marv Albert, which means there's no Dick Stockton, which means there's no Bob Costas, and on and on and on. So, yeah, that was a very circuitous way to answer your question.
And just one quick bonus question, just for my own edification. There's a lot of different ways to pronounce I-A-N. So Ian, Ian. If you're a Seinfeld fan, you might remember Ian from that one
Ian,
episode.
I do. Beautiful suits.
Yep. Yeah. So when you got to the point in your career where people consistently got it right, Ian, never said Ian or anything like that, is that when you knew you finally made it?
Yeah, I think my parents, if they were with us today, that would probably be the most proud that they could be, that somehow they've helped make Ian somewhat acceptable in culture. The funny part about it is when my parents named me, there were a few things in mind. One, my father's mother's name was Ida, and they wanted to name me after her, so they went with an I name. They did not like Ivan. They did not like Ira. And they thought Ian Eagle didn't have a ring to it. They were in show business, so they thought about things like this. They thought Ian Eagle sounded a lot better than Ian Eagle. And they liked the I sound because of Ida. As I grew up and had to correct people, and oftentimes I didn't correct them. You know, in school, I would pick and choose my spots. If it was my permanent teacher, I let them know ahead of time, hey, it's pronounced Ian. If it was a substitute teacher, I didn't bother correct them. If they said Ian, I lived with it. I was okay with it. But somewhere along the way, I recognized that if you just added BR to IAN, it was universally accepted as Brian. And as you break down words, it made too much sense to me that I was the one fighting this hopeless battle about Ian and Ian when you have Brian right there for the taking. So that's been my my vehicle to explain to people, if I want to take the time, that it's just Brian without the BR. Maybe the best pronunciation I dealt with, and this was on the air, the first match I ever did for Tennis Channel with Martina Navratilova at the French Open, the entire match, she called me Jan. And it was glorious. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Someone corrected her the next day, and then she came up to me. She's like, why didn't you correct me? I said, because it was fantastic. I smiled every time you said Jan. No one had ever called me Jan in my life. So that's another alias I could go by, Jan Eagle.
Well, I think Martinez is a big fan of Jan Mahimi, right?
It might be. It might be Jan Mahimi. That you nailed it, John. Good call.
All right. Well, hey, thank you so much. This was a fantastic conversation. I know I enjoyed it. I'm sure Derek and Armand did, and I'm quite sure that our listeners will as well. Thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure, guys. Keep up the great work.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed that interview with Ian Eagle as much as we did. And again, if you want more where that came from, you can subscribe to the SMW podcast feed for interviews past, present, and future. And like I said before, next up, Kenny Albert this week. So plenty more interview content. Well, thank you to Ian for his time. Thank you to Armand and to Derek. And thanks to you for listening. We'll be back with more stuff very soon.